Marshall, call the case and we'll
sure.
A few introductions before we begin with the argument.
Okay, thanks.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Warkey, Judge Larkin, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning and welcome to this February 23rd, 2022 session of and panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are proceeding today by Zoom interactive video, but counsel, you should be aware that we're only making an audio recording, not a video recording. So do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. The matter on next for our hearing, our third and last argument, is Harper versus Tesmer Tuck. Counsel, each side will have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional 5 minutes for appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for a rebuttal. And with that, counsel for appellant, now you may proceed.
Okay. Thank you very much. It's been a while since I've been up here, so I have to excuse that. But so the first thing I would like to say, Your Honor, I'm representing the appellant, Shannon Harper, in this matter. But before I even go into my argument, one of the issues that's been raised is preservation of issues for appeal. And there were three issues that were raised by respondent in their reply brief. The first one was whether we preserve the issue of the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act, that the statute does not provide a private cause of action. The second was, that was their fourth issue. The fifth issue in which they said it was not preserved was the issue of vicarious liability. And the last one was the issue regarding a claim against the Minnesota Board of Nursing. Under Rule 133.03, it specifically states that within 14 days after service of the appellant's statement, the respondent can serve on all parties and file with proof of service its statement clarifying or supplementing the appellant's statement. It did so with regard to the issues and specifically with regard to the Board of Nursing issue. Otherwise, with regard to the other issues, when I submitted my statement of the case, I specifically talked about generally immunity from liability under the Federal Healthcare Quality Improvement Act as a number 5 and number 9. I stated any other issues that were raised in the record and proceedings below by the nature and scope of the appeal, thinking that that would be sufficient. And looking at some case law that's supportive of that, the case Minnesota Court of Appeals decision of Perilla and Perilla, a Court of Appeals decision of September 5, 2003, discusses that at page 5, as well as a case of George v. State Baker, a 2006 Minnesota Supreme Court decision, 724 Northwest 2nd. Page 14. So in all, Your Honor, I think we have clearly, and these issues were argued below at the district court, and both parties argue them at the Court of Appeals. So I'm requesting that the court consider that all issues have been preserved on appeal. Thank you. With regard to the issues before the court, it is important, key that binding authority for the initial issue of the breach of contract is the case of medical staff of Avera Marshall. Regional Medical Center versus Marshall, 857 Northwest 2nd. Supreme Court decision, page 695, specifically looking at pages 701 to 704. That's the decision that is binding precedent for establishing that there is a contract between providers of medical staff and the hospital. It is interesting that neither the district court in her decision nor the respondents in their reply brief discuss that decision. It seems incomprehensible to me that the concept of that decision was also proved in the subsequent decision of Canaan versus Prague de Canaan, Minnesota Court of Appeals decision of 2069, decided July 9th, 2018. And even the case of Meister, which was subsequent to the Supreme Court decision, and that the full site is in our table of authorities, still agree that there was a bylaws established a contract between the providers and the hospital, but that the hospital could unilaterally change them. That did not happen in this case. There's no question that the contract by way of the medical staff bylaws and its associated policies and procedures of the medical staff of North Memorial Health Hospital were in place and effective on June 3rd, 2019. They had been placed in effect on February 4th, I believe, 2019. And to look at the case, I think the district court talked about this as being a unilateral versus bilateral contract. Under the concept even discussed in the Hall versus the City of Plainview, a Supreme Court decision of 2021-954 NW 2nd 254, looking at page 261, it is clear that this was clearly a bilateral contract between the providers and the hospital.
You're arguing, Ms. Garvis, that your client didn't get a fair hearing. And of course, North Memorial is saying, look, this is our, our responsibility. Is that the thrust of your claim, is that your client was not given a fair hearing, not notified of the hearing?
No, that's not the thrust of this. The thrust of the argument is that North Memorial did not implement the policies and procedures in its credentialing and discipline policy that they were obligated to implement as part of their contract with my client. And to be perfectly clear, what did that mean in terms of inquiry? What was really necessary? The fair hearing is at the end of the process.
Well, right. I understand the fair hearing is at the end, but the district court judge determined that you didn't present an issue that was triable fact. Did you, in any of the allegations, allege that there was bad faith or something incorrect in terms of the report that was made?
I'm sorry, when you say report, what do you say?
The written report concerning the conduct that occurred at North Memorial, the failure to provide the full handoff, the excessive meds, and the standards.
Well, yes, we disputed that. You're talking about the national practice.
Right, but what I'm asking is that, did you provide any evidence or allegations of malice or bad faith in connection with issuing that report?
When you say evidence, there's evidence in the record. There were 43 documents that were submitted.
Evidence of malice. Tell me one or two examples of evidence of malice, that they were out to get her, or there was malice under the statutory definition of that.
Well, first of all, say, Your Honor, that malice is a question to be actually determined by the jury. But if you talk about malice, they knew or should have known, number one, that with regard to the medications given, if we talk about given to this patient, that there was no specific amount of medications that needed to be given to this patient, because this was there was no established amount, number one. Number two, in terms of looking at the comparables, there were no comparables, because this, if you look, we had the report of my client's expert, Dr. Martin Birch, who said that there weren't. Dr. Sarah Storrs, her deposition testimony discussed this as well. That's number two. So we talk about the comparables, the order sets. That was a third item that was discussed implicating the fact that my client didn't comply with the standards of practice. There was no standards that said the order sets need to be applied in a certain way. This was something that simply that defendant Tesmer Tuck decided that should be done. There's no evidence in the record that establishes this. It's a question of fact. This is a question of fact to be determined by the jury. So those are three things that, yes, that I would think that was in respects established evidence of malice. Is it reasonable to assume it might be a question of fact? It could be, but they haven't established anything that shows otherwise. And in fact, they didn't follow the process through to know. They had a trauma peer review committee meeting after my client received notice that the NPDB report had been submitted. That's not the process. How can you have a contract with a hospital and then not have them comply with the policies and procedures that are required under it? Makes no sense. I don't mean to yell. I'm sorry. I apologize if I raise my voice. I just get emotional about this case. And I'm not anti-hospital. And I'm not anti, it's just that who would want to have a contract? What would you want to have a contract with an institution? And then the institution decides they're just not going to do it. But they're going to submit a report against you. You can't do it that way. You have to go through the process. And I outline that on page 11 of my appellate of my brief to the court, that in terms of submitting a report to the National Practitioner Databank, certain requirements have to be met. And part of that is a thorough investigation. The fair hearing is part of it at the end if it's necessary. But you have to go through the investigative process to get there. And they didn't do that. I don't know why, but they didn't. But yet they decided they were going to submit a report to the National Practitioner Databank. It got voided eventually. They submitted a report to the Board of Nursing. We got it dismissed. How can all of that be, okay, it's just so, can't be. I'm sorry, those are the things I talked about, the comparables, the amount of medications, the information about this specific patient. They didn't have information about a patient complaint. That's another thing they said, patient complaint. No, the Dr. Gibson didn't, if you read his deposition, he didn't say that the patient complained about the DCD procedure. He said they complained about how the patient was handled after the procedure. But of course they implemented and said, no, it was during the procedure. That's not true. So I just asked this court to look at the facts, look at them clearly. They tried to say that my client waived the contract. What did they look at to waive the contract? They looked at California law. California has a long history of how they interpret waiver law. That's not Minnesota law. There's no precedent in Minnesota. They said my client submitted on March, and I'm using all my time, I don't know, but submitted on March 18th. A note saying that she would be willing to extend her privileges. She didn't say that. She just said, if I'm here, I'd like to talk to somebody about the possibility of working. And everything else flows from the breach of contract, the defamation claim. They claim they had a peer review committee. We did this dispute that. There was no committee. It was a one-person show. So the facts are there in the record, even in their own answers to interrogatories, which you submitted, which we have submitted on the record. So, Judge, did I answer your question? Okay.
Thank you. Yes.
So, if we talk about what was required here, if we talk about the breach of contract. Was required in terms of inquiry. If we look at the credentialing discipline policy on pages 39 to 44, anybody can bring a complaint to anyone. You can bring it to the vice president of medical affairs, but that doesn't end there. That's where it starts. And then it goes to the eventually to other committees, and the multi-specialty peer review committee gets it. And they have to report to the medical executive committee. And then the medical executive committee and or the multi-specialty peer review committee can make a determination of how they want to proceed. But, you don't have a, and that's how it's supposed to proceed. And then at that point, that's when, if there's going to be a report to the National Practitioner Data Bank, there's notice to the individual, and, you know, there could be an opportunity for an interview or a fair hearing. But ultimately, that's how it's supposed to go. And that didn't happen. They breached the contract, and the court should find that to be the case. I know my time is up, but I believe the court, with, you know, all the other arguments that we have addressed in the brief, and, you know, if you have questions, I'm happy to address them on my rebuttal.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes to do just that.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. Pari Magera, Fredrickson, and Byron for the respondents. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you.
Great. Thank you. This case is about what happened after serious questions arose about the clinical care that appellant provided. North Memorial investigated the clinical case, discovered that appellant had ordered very high doses of medication without supporting documentation. And at the conclusion of the investigation, North Memorial did what public policy supports and what the law permits. It made reports to the appropriate authorities, the National Practitioner Data Bank and the Board of Nursing. Appellant's claims fail at summary judgment. We ask this court to affirm the district court's order in that respect. There's no contract right that was violated, and respondent's conduct is protected by a slew of privileges and immunities. I'd like to address a few issues that Ms. Garvis raised here before we sort of launch into it. The first is that I'm still not hearing a particular provision of any contract, policy, or bylaw that was violated here. There's no place to hang appellant's hat on the breach claim. She thinks that it should have been handled differently, but there isn't contract language that allows that. A report to the NPDB does not trigger a hearing. Nothing required the VPMA in the language of the policies to refer the investigation on so that it went through the pathway in its complete form. And the reason it didn't go through the pathway, just factually, is because Ms. Harper had left the hospital, right? And so by the time it would have moved through that process, she was already gone. And so there was no reason to proceed along the disciplinary path, because there were no privileges left to be disciplined at that point. I want to talk briefly about the issue of malice. Malice is a jury question, I understand, but only if there are facts sufficient to support that kind of a finding. That's supported by the Harvett and Bull cases, both resolved at summary judgment, where the plaintiff had no evidence of malice. And the Frankson case, which is a Minnesota Supreme Court case, I want to say from the mid-80s, it's cited in appellant's brief, that actually reversed a jury finding because there wasn't sufficient evidence of malice to even submit that issue to the jury. Here, where there's no evidence of malice, there's not any reason to disturb the qualified privilege or the sort of statutory immunities that hinge on that finding. I hear and understand that appellant disagrees with the conclusions that this investigation reached, but that's not a finding of malice. There's no evidence that any of the participants in this process on the North Memorial side had any personal animus towards Ms. Harper. In fact, Dr. Tessimer Tuck had never met Ms. Harper before this. There's not the kind of evidence that this is a sham investigation or that the findings were not truly the findings. The findings reported were not truly the findings that were made. With that sort of behind us, I'd like to sort of run through the claims really quickly, if that works for the court. I'll start with appellant's contract claim. We ask the court affirm the grant of summary judgment at respondent's favor. As an initial matter, the individual respondents cannot be liable on a contract theory or a good faith and fair dealing theory for that matter, because they don't have a contractual relationship with appellant. They're employees of the hospital. The contracts run between North Memorial and the appellant. With respect to the process privileges, or the process sort of protections, hearings, notice, there's no contract language to hang those rights on because the triggering conditions didn't occur. The MEC didn't make a recommendation that would require notice. An adverse action was not taken that would require a hearing or give right to a hearing, and factually appellant actually didn't request a hearing. So there's a number of barriers there. Appellant's real argument is here is that she shouldn't have been reported to the NPDB. And that's really about compliance with the regulations, which are not incorporated into the contract. The contract doesn't speak to reportability, doesn't incorporate those federal standards. It's just not a contract claim. On the defamation claim, we also ask that the court affirm the grant of summary judgment in respondent's favor. Here again, Dr. Gibson and Ms. Thorson did not make any statements, undisputed that they did not make any statement that appellant alleges was defamatory. They didn't participate in, review, or read. They didn't make the decision to make reports. They were just uninvolved in the reporting process. There's no their testimony in that regard is undisputed. It's the summary judgment in their favor should be affirmed. With respect to North Memorial, which made the report to the National Practitioner Data Bank, and Dr. Tessimer Tuck, who made the report to the Board of Nursing, even assuming that those reports create questions of facts on the elements of defamation, they're protected by a qualified privilege under Minnesota law. Whether there is a qualified privilege is a question of law. That's in the Frankson and Lewis cases. Bowl, Harbit, is a sort of a slew of cases that talk about that decision being made as a matter of law, including in a summary judgment record. That would be Bowl and Harbit are both summary judgment cases. Public policy favors issues of patient safety reaching the appropriate authorities. And it's undisputed that these were confidential reports made to the appropriate authorities. It's not like they put this on social media. This is not a widespread publication. There was a substantial investigation before the reports were made. It's undisputed that Dr. Tessimer Tuck and Ms. Thorson interviewed like a dozen people and reviewed this patient's medical records, the medical records of patients that were most closely comparable, not perfectly comparable because human beings are variable in their sort of health conditions, and reviewed the policies and order sets. Undisputed that appellant ordered many times more medication than the maximum recommended in the order sets and used in the comparable cases to the extent that such cases were identifiable. When there's no evidence of malice, I said this already, in the qualified privilege context, that's common law malice, so actual ill will or a design to causelessly and wantonly injure the appellant. If there's no evidence that could meet that standard, summary judgment is appropriate in the defendant's favor. So we ask that the defamation claims be dismissed, or the dismissal of those claims be affirmed on appeal because there's no evidence of malice and strong evidence of a qualified privilege. Similarly, the good faith and fair dealing claims, to the extent that they're different than the contract claims, dismissal ought to be affirmed because there's no evidence of bad faith or ill motive. This will be a repeated theme. And then even if there were questions of fact on the various elements of these claims, there's layers of immunity here that apply, both state and federal. Point out that the HICUA statute has a savings clause, which means that to the extent that state law is more generous, state law will control. So first, HICUA, that's the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act, a federal statute, provides that a person who reports to the NPDB is immune if the reporter is without actual knowledge of the falsity of the information that's contained in the reports. The amounts and types of medications is undisputed. The lack of documentation is undisputed. Comparison to the doses between the order sets and what was actually ordered in the comparator cases and what was actually ordered, that's undisputed. Appellant obviously disagrees that her care did not meet the standard and that the handoff wasn't thorough, sort of those kinds of qualifying pieces of it, but there's no evidence at all that North Memorial made those statements with actual knowledge that they were false. To the extent that this is really about reportability, that's irrelevant to the analysis under the immunity because the statute provides that immunity is only lost if the information contained in the report is knowingly false. And here it's whether the underlying conditions met the requirements for reportability under the NPDB's statute regulations and guidance is not the information contained in the report. We also argue that and believe that the actions, to the extent that they emerge out of a peer review, or excuse me, a professional review action within the meaning of the HICUA statute, would also be immune because they were taken in the reasonable belief that the action was in the furtherance of healthcare quality. There's no rebuttal to the respondent's testimony that they did this because they cared about patient safety. After a reasonable effort to obtain the facts of the matter, again, there's no dispute about what the steps that were involved in the investigation were, although there's obviously appellant disagrees with the conclusions that it reached. And after procedures that were fair under the circumstances and in the reasonable belief that the action was warranted by the facts. I'll talk briefly about procedures that were fair under the circumstances, because that seems like where the sort of weight of the argument is here. Here where appellant left the facility before any of the sort of procedural rights would have attached under the bylaws, the procedure was fair under these circumstances. We've cited to a Western District of New York case with analogous facts, that is a provider left during the course of an investigation, and that court held that his claims failed because the hospital was immune, even though he had not been given a hearing because he was gone by the time the hearing right would have attached. Appellant makes an argument in her brief that he was provided more than she was, but that case talks about that he received an email that referenced the incident and informed him that the case was referred for quality review. That's not substantially different than what this appellant received, which was a telephone call alerting her that the case was under peer review and giving her the opportunity to provide her recitation of what happened and her rationale. To the extent there is harm stemming from the report to the Board of Nursing, Dr. Tessa Murtuck and North Memorial, to the extent it would be responsible for her conduct, is also immune because the report was made in good faith. That's under Minnesota Statute 148.264. Minnesota law actually required Dr. Tessa Murtuck, herself a licensed professional, to report because she believed that appellant did not meet the minimum standards for nursing practice. And that is a required and mandatory report under the Nurse Practice Act. There's just no evidence of bad faith here, as we've covered a number of times. And then the last sort of layer of immunity that appellant would have to get past in order for this to be an actionable claim, or for there to be actionable claims here that would survive summary judgment, is Minnesota Statute 145.63, what we've called the Review Organization Statute. That's similar to HICUA, but it's a little different. It immunizes the actions of a review organization, which is defined both as hospitals and the committees they establish for certain purposes, when the actions of the hospital or the committee take in a reasonable belief that the action is warranted by the facts after a reasonable effort to ascertain the facts and not motivated by malice. Appellant argues that this wasn't a committee because Dr. Tessa Murtuck and Ms. Thorson working together aren't basically enough people to be a committee. The statute doesn't actually create a minimum number of members for a committee or otherwise define what a committee has to look like. Also point out that a hospital itself is a review organization under that statute. And as a corporate entity, of course, the hospital can't operate except through its employees and officers. And Dr. Tessa Murtuck, as the VPMA, was acting on behalf of the hospital here. So the committee question is sort of falls out. Again, the sort of contours of this investigation are undisputed. Number of interviews, including with appellant, review of policies, order sets, medical records, including medical records of comparable cases. Dr. Tessa Murtuck actually testified here that in her deposition that the comparable cases she chose, she actually was very generous to the appellant in her selection of cases because she chose cases that the procedure went for the full 90 minutes, which meant that the doses would be sort of inherently higher. If the procedure was shorter, the doses would be lower. So she gave her the benefit of the doubt in the way she selected the cases. It's undisputed there was no documentation. Again, there's no evidence of malice, ill will, and intent to injure the appellant. And so the actions of the review organization, whether the committee or the hospital itself, that ultimately led to the NPDB report and the report to the board are protected. If there are no further questions, I don't think I need the last 51 seconds. We ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. It doesn't appear to be any other questions from the panel. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Simply, counsel has reiterated what's
in. If you could just, for the record, restate your name for this part of the
argument. Oh, I'm sorry. Sure. Marlene Garvis for the appellant.
Thank you.
It appears that counsel for respondents has simply restated what's in their brief. It is clear that what counsel has stated in terms of what happened during this procedure are factual material issues of fact,
Counsel, this is Judge Larkin. Could I interrupt you with a question, please?
Sure.
Could you just succinctly identify for the panel exactly what a provision of the contract was breached? What's your basis for a breach of contract claim?
Yes. I'm looking at the credentialing and discipline policy.
Okay.
And the discipline, and I'm looking specifically at articles. If we start out with articles 4.3 and 4.8, we talk about articles 6.1 and 6.2, 6.3, 6.4, 6.5.
And generally, what do those provisions say?
And 6.8. Well, they establish a mechanism by which inquiries about an provider's practice are to be handled. Okay, they establish the obligations of the entity. In this case, it's these are the Northern Moyle Health Hospital's medical staff bylaws. They establish how those inquiries are to be based in conjunction with the peer review policy of the hospital, which further discusses, let me just get to that in a minute, that policy, the peer review policy, in greater detail lays out exactly how that is to be done. And I will just briefly discuss that. So a concern comes, let's say, to the VPMA, which is the Vice President of Medical Affairs. She brings the concern to the medical, she brings it to the multi-staff, multi-specialty peer review committee. Then it goes to the medical executive committee for decision making and in terms of how the inquiries are to be followed up. That's an obligation. That is not something that's just kind of happenstance. That's how the process is supposed to go.
How does that contractual relationship extend to the individuals that are named and not simply Harper and North Memorial?
So how does that extend to the individual? Is that what your question was, Your Honor? So at some point then, if they have an inquiry, then at some point the individual is notified that there's an inquiry about your practice. They can do it by way of a letter of information. They can ask the person to come in and have an interview. There's a committee, but. And then they can go further if they decide to discipline the individual. They would tell the individual that's what's going to happen. And ultimately, they can decide to make a report to the, let's say it's a physician, a board of medical practice. Here was the board of nursing and the National Practitioner Data Bank. That's how the process is supposed to go. That's the process. That's the process that's in place under the bylaws and the policies and procedures of North Memorial Health Hospital. There is no way that what North Memorial Health Hospital did in this case is circumvented for some reason. You know, that's the process. if we allow that to happen this time, what's going to happen next time? This is a big institution. We are out there saying that an institution can just bypass its own policies and procedures about how what its obligations are to its providers. And I just want to make one other comment because I know my time is going to be up. So I want, first of all, I hope I answered your question. That's the process that's to be followed. I see that
your time has expired, but you may go ahead and sum up.
Okay. So the other thing I want to really stress is this. With regard to the peer review law, I must just say 2 points, and then I appreciate the opportunity to do that. Number one, everything that counsel for respondents have said is a fact issue. Whether or not they were comparables, whether or not she gave too much medication, whether or not they follow the order sets. There's contrary evidence in the record. It presents fact issues. These are issues for the jury. She's the only one. Counsel didn't say agreed to or confirmed by a trauma surgeon. They avoided even having the trauma surgeon who knew about it. Dr. Storrs knew about it more than anyone. But anyway, those are all fact issues. The other point I want to make is this. Under 145.61, it's not a single person operation. If you look at their answers to interrogatories, which are in the record, it specifically says that Dr. Tesmertuck was allowed to go ahead with the investigation assisted by Nurse Thorson. In their brief, they say that they formed a group. No, that isn't what they said in their answers to interrogatories.
Thank you, Ms. Garvis. I think you've summed up and you've thoroughly presented your argument in brief. Your time has expired.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you to both counsel for your written arguments and for your oral arguments today. The matter is submitted.